Right, here's up. The whole point is like you ask a good question, we give you some stuff.
Fun.
Some stuff.
Pizza.
Fun
more cattle prod.
Pizza. More pizza.
Whatever you
right.
like. We're exactly. your friends. You can trust yeah, us.
Exactly. This is Hacking 201. This is how right. this works.
So I guess they're organizing the pass the hat, and that'll happen momentarily. So, all right, for we're only 3 minutes late this time, so that's good. This is Hacking 201. Who is a Hacking 201 virgin? Who is, this is your yeah. first time at Hacking 201? Okay.
Oh, my God, there's a lot.
Right.
There's a lot.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you for showing up.
All right, this is.
Without any kind of, like, impetus.
All right, let's give him the history. We'll give him the brief history here. So,
sure.
Back in, I think, 1996, that's when my first badge was, the powers that be at Dragon Con decided maybe this internet thing was going to catch on and we should start having internet stuff at Dragon Con.
Yeah.
So I get a call from a buddy of mine at Georgia Tech and says, hey, I need you to really do Johnny X, like, up to 11, the persona, and, yeah. like, dress up like a 80s cyberpunk or something and come be the hacker on a panel. I'm like, well, I get in for free? Sure. Do I get booze? Yeah, I'm there. So it went over well, and they decided in 97 they were going to try a hacker-type panel every day, a computer panel, something like that. They didn't know what they were going to call the track yet.
Right.
So we did. They came back to me and said, you did well. Can you help us figure out what we're going to do on these four panels, one per day? And I thought for a second. I said, we'll do Hacking 101, 201, and 301.
Yeah.
And I think they did Webcam Girls for 401 back when that was a thing. So yeah. Is it still a thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't mean to offend anyone. I mean, I know... I mean, I know internet porn is definitely a thing because I used to work in that industry, but I didn't know if webcam girls were still a thing. So, yeah, I'll tell about that later. This is not PG-13. It's after 10 o'clock, and we're going to fucking cuss like sailors. So
exactly.
If you got little kids here, I apologize. Yeah. I mean, not every other word will be profanity.
Kids out.
That gets boring.
Please,
no. Kids can stay. They, you know, We should teach them how to curse effectively and amusingly.
Okay,
that's But, yeah, this is
that
after
too.
10 o'clock. This is an adult.
That
yeah,
too.
This is an adult program, so this is not a kiddie program. So.
Yeah, you have been warned.
For the first time in second grade, and I remember none of it.
Sure.
There are recordings. There
All
are
good.
Recordings.
All good.
Just out of curiosity,
yes.
Did we give you a beer?
No, but I think you might have given my dad.
And if he gave you one, that's fine.
Yeah,
okay.
Nice.
Good dad.
Nice.
Good dad. So we were trying to figure out how are we going to get people to, you know, Hacking 101, that'll be the serious one. Hacking 201, we realized that was going to be the end of the day, so we were able to go as long as we wanted. Hacking 301, we called the recovery, you know,
right.
for the next morning.
That's tomorrow morning.
No, they don't
it'll
do 301
be
anymore. They actually have legitimate programming instead
really?
Of 301.
No, okay.
Yeah. It's no longer just a space to fill with hungover people bullshitting.
Oh, wow, okay.
So we had a lot of time to kill in 201, and we were like, how are we going to compete with the masquerade and scantily clad women and other parties and stuff like that? And it was like, oh, free beer. So despite the fact that the convention says we can't do that and the hotels don't allow it, and we figured we're hackers if we're not intelligent enough to get a bunch of free booze in and distribute it amongst
sure.
all of our friends we don't deserve to drink. So the way Hacking 201 went, we collected about... usually around $500-$600 during Hacking 101. We'd make a booze run Saturday night because at the time Georgia wasn't allowed to sell. You couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays. We wanted
right.
to drink on Sunday.
Right.
And Hacking 201 was, if you ask a good question, we'll toss you a good beer or other drink of your choice. If you ask a bad question, you'll probably get heckled. And the worst question of the evening, we got the raunchiest, nastiest 40-ouncer we could find, and that was served overhand. So
nice.
We eventually dropped that. I think we broke a light once when we did that, so we
yeah.
stopped that. But yeah, that's Hacking 201.
I remember that.
Just a sec. We got away with it for, I think, 17 years before they finally caught us and told us to knock it off.
Right.
And so, yeah, we still figure if we're not intelligent enough to slip things in to share with our friends, then we don't deserve liquid refreshment. So there you go. And if you want more explicit details, the recording stops at midnight, and then we can talk about all the really cool shit. So
welcome to Hacking 201.
That's the history of Hacking 201.
Welcome to Hacking 201. Really, this is awesome. This is awesome.
Okay, just so I'd offer. And we appreciate you. We appreciate you
part
putting
of
up
this,
with us.
Part of this is you. Part of this is you, Q&A. So we're going to be waiting for you to have
this,
questions
this,
for
this
us.
This panel is entirely audience-driven. And,
I have 63 slides.
And
we can go. We can.
And zapper-driven, thing.
Yeah,
this thing, zapper-driven.
I'll tell the Caliprod story in a second.
Yes.
It's question answer driven. How many people were here at Hacking 101, newbies?
Yeah.
It's like Hacking 101, only we blather on longer, and there's a lot more bullshit and profanity and drinking.
Yes.
So, and it goes all night. And
there's
we
a lot
you
more
with,
drinking.
We provide you with pizza as
lot
well,
more drinking.
And
yes.
News,
and pizza.
As you know, and that'll continue until everything
yes.
runs out.
Yeah, yeah.
Traditionally, we break around midnight because some of us will be drinking heavily until then, and we'll need to go urinate most profusely. We'll have demos if people have brought toys to play with. We'll set them up then. We usually break up into groups around the room, and people
focus on different
things. Should we
introduce the panel? We should
introduce
the panel.
Yeah, we should.
Should we?
Real quick, you had a question. Real quick, no? Later.
Yeah,
okay.
It's still bothering me. So you're recording this.
Yeah.
And
right.
You declared your plans on recording.
Yeah. Do you think the powers
sure.
that be actually listen to these recordings?
No, they don't listen
this,
to these.
Again, it took them
they don't
17 fucking years before
no,
they realized this was going on.
They don't listen
to
these, truly.
And the only reason we got caught, it wasn't because someone listened to recording. It was because someone who usually, in case you hadn't noticed, all of the reality tracks are on this floor,
yeah.
most in this section of the hotel, space
yeah.
track, science track, EFF, and skeptics on the other side, the reality tracks. We had someone who didn't realize the reality tracks existed show up about 5 years ago when we were doing the pizza had shown up and we had parties. I think we had the Tesla coil still at that point. And this guy thought this was the craziest fucking thing he had ever seen at DragonCon. It was beautiful. He was even more freaked out when he realized half the conversations he were listening to were real. This was actual real technical stuff people were talking about, and it just blew his mind. And he decided, there need to be more parties and events like this at DragonCon. This is amazing. I need to go tell my friend Pat Henry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Victim of our own success, and we had to tone it down for a while. I thought of doing milk and cookies the following year, but yeah.
But that wasn't the guy with the neutron reactor or whatever it is, right?
No, the nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's go ahead and introduce the panelists.
Yeah,
please. Have we gotten all the serious stuff done, and we've got the money collecting done?
We're trying, yeah.
Yeah, let's start at this end, and we'll work
there we
our
go.
Way down.
There we go.
My name is Jay Freeman. Everyone online knows me as Sorek.
Sorek.
I run Cydia, the alternative to the App Store for jailbroken iPhones.
Yeah.
I know a lot about compilers and decompilers and static analysis and linguistics, weirdly, if you have questions on that. And I am now involved in one of those silly cryptocurrency projects. We're trying to do essentially the same thing that Silicon Valley is doing in season 4. We even hired the guy who did the consulting from the company for that. It makes certain that we stay true to script. So I know a lot about cryptocurrencies.
Cool. So I'm Randall Schwartz. You might know me from
Pearl.
Pearl and Floss Weekly. How many people have subscribed to Floss Weekly? There we go. A few.
We need more. URLs.
Yeah, thank you. Floss Weekly. And I'm also like now cool into Dart and Flutter. So there we go.
Yay, Google.
Yes.
For those of you who aren't aware, the amazingly selling book Learning Perl that O'Reilly put out, which is like the Bible for Learning Perl, this is the guy who wrote it.
I'm the guy. I'm that guy. I am that guy.
Did you bring any copies to autograph and sell?
I didn't, because people will bring them up and make me sign them.
Okay.
But not today.
We'll wait here.
Stage whisper. They're making the booze run. Do you need any volunteers, and shall we take requests for what people want? Again, talk to this man, my lovely and talented assistant.
Right. Caviar. No caviar,
oh,
please.
I have a request. For the love of God, please Guinness me.
Yes.
Thank you.
Guinness. Like an old-fashioned.
Beer. What? Wait, there's an easy way to solve this. All right, liquor.
Yes.
All right. Beer.
No.
All right. So. All right. So basically.
The beer loses. Beer
wait,
loses.
Wait. Wait. Oh, yeah. Wine has alcohol too. Okay. How about this? A bottle of wine, red. Bottle of red wine. I assume that if we get a 12-pack of Guinness, there'll probably still be some left over if the beer drinkers only have one. So a 12-pack of Guinness, a bottle of wine, and whatever you want, man.
Give me your finest box of wine.
All right. So the whole night is like this, folks. The whole night is like this. We're going to continue the introductions down this way while I text him a reminder of what he's picking up. All right. We are saluting the Russians tonight.
They
may be bastards, but damn, they can hack.
That's called liquor as a service. That's what that is.
We salute the Russians.
We still beat their asses to the moon, though.
Yes. We beat them to the moon. We did beat them to the moon.
So I'm Matt Blaze. I do cryptography and computer security and voting and stuff.
He's smart. He's very smart.
Okay. And I'm Nash. I work at Electronic Frontier Foundation, where I get to we have a network of 78 right now, including EF Georgia, grassroots organizations in 26 states, and I literally get to go around the country and work with awesome folks that are doing advocacy in their communities and teaching people in their community at digital security and how to use different tools to keep their information secure. So I pretty much have the best job.
My name is Ray Kelly, and I do web application security. So I work for a company called Micro Focus. It kind of used to be HP before it blew into more pieces than Alderaan. And so if you guys use SCA, Static Code Analyzer, or Web Inspect, I helped write Web Inspect back in 2002.
Cool. Hey guys, my name is Xavier Ash. I've been hacking since the late 80s, been in the security industry since the early 90s, been doing a lot of consulting. I've got experience kind of all over the place. And so right now I am managing a incident response team for a local financial team, which we can talk about after midnight.
All right, and I'm Johnny X. That's my secret hacker name, Drew Myers. Let's see, I got involved with the Nashville 2600 scene back around 1993. I ran the group for a few years. I've started or been involved with several hacker cons in the Southeast. I was an award-winning radio DJ for about 9 years, even though I had no business being in the radio station, and it took the owners 5 years to figure out that I was not affiliated in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And by that time, I'd won some awards, so they couldn't get rid of me.
Yes.
Social engineering, in case you couldn't tell. Bullshitted my way into Dragon Con and got them to essentially pay for me to be here for over a decade. Yay! helped start this stuff primarily so we could do, some semi-serious hacker outreach and guide people towards the white hat path and away from the black hat path, but also just basically wanted to throw my own party and have free booze and alcohol with a couple hundred of my friends. So there
exactly.
you go.
Exactly. Welcome to a couple hundred of our friends. Welcome to a couple hundred of our friends.
So the way we traditionally start this off, do we have an audience mic? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Audience question and answer.
It's
That's the
cube.
First hand I saw
it's
go
the cube.
Up.
No,
do
no
not
I think his name is Mike. I think you're asked about an audience mic. It's Mike.
Do not talk.
Hi, Mike.
The cube.
Mike in the audience, you get to ask the first question.
Hey,
so make
Spencer,
it, make,
but I'll call
make
the
it good.
The
make
night,
it good. No pressure.
Please.
Everyone's waiting on you.
Please.
Don't suck.
We had a big year with Meltdown and Spectre. Would you guys like to speculate or comment on what you believe the next nation state actor level breach is going to be, whether it's the chip level or somewhere else, or if you had to be the guy who was running a three-level government agency, where would you be attempting to get the next exploit that we think is going to be kind of on that level, and with that term, kind of longevity that we see from both those weaknesses?
Mike, the audience member, that is a very good first question, but that is the wrong first question.
There's
we will answer
be more.
It, but does anyone know what the official first question should be? Your hand went up.
You got a free beer? Is that the first question?
All I can say is there's going to be more. There's going to be more.
May I have a beer, please?
You can have a beer. Okay, now we'll answer your question. Who wants to take
it? Can I have a beer, please? And then the question I just asked previously.
Go. Yes, you can have one, too, but I forgot to say after he asked his first question, that question no longer works, but you got in under the wire, so yes, you too get the first
question.
Yes.
Smart man, all right.
Come have a beer. Come have a beer.
See, all right. You have lovely young lady in the back will be next after we get this this question answered, and this could take a while. So yeah, there's a lot of ground to cover. Yeah. We don't have the beer up there. It's back up here. It's back there somewhere, I think.
See, the thing about the like 0-day vulnerability, like high end, like big news crap, that's not what hackers use. Not even nation state use. They use the stuff that's 2 to 3 to 6 months, maybe even 2 to 3 years old. That's the stuff that gets through. So the nation state hackers, the funded hackers, the people that are using stuff to get stuff done, 0-day just doesn't necessarily cut it. That makes a lot of headlines. It makes people that do patch management very, sweaty. But that the bottom line is that, I'm in instant response. I see the stuff that gets through. And that's not, it's never the 0-day stuff. It's always the stuff that's old that somebody forgot to patch.
That said, though, I think it depends on what their target is. So in the case of the hacking team leaks that came out, and we were looking at what the NSO group had met, was utilizing I think it was like an Israeli cyber security company under contract with some government agencies in order to target a United Arab Emirates human rights activist. That was a 0-day. I mean, that was the kind of thing where when people when Mansour, I'm not going to get his name, Arabic name, when he noticed it going on in his phone, and he immediately sent the hyperlink that he didn't click to some people on a penetration testing team whose name I'm also forgetting right now. But when they started pulling it apart, they were just fascinated by the fact that it was a so far unknown bug that they had used in order to build a live working jailbreak stack for the phone. So it sort of depends on this on the scenario and the profileness of the target, because what ends up happening is that you end up burning that bug. Like the reason why what he's saying is almost entirely true is that
if you can't get your cup, if you can't separate a cup, you can't.
All right, we're starting with cup hacking. We'll move on to bottle hacking.
Yeah, the reason why what he's saying, though, is almost entirely true is because if you don't, if you use a 0-day against some random person and they figure out what's going on, then you've burned that 0-day. And yet it is almost always the case that the person is not running the up-to-date version of absolutely everything, and so you're able to use an old bug.
So how many people have heard of Reality Winner? Right. So she was just sentenced after pleading guilty to leaking NSA documents about the Russian hacking of U.S. elections in U.S. election infrastructure in 2016. And basically, she released about 4 pages of documents that. Basically described in a fair amount of detail an incredibly pedestrian phishing operation against state and local election officials and election vendors, right? I mean, there's nothing in there that described any super 0-day stuff. They used they used phishing attacks with relatively convincing return addresses that they registered domain names for. Why? Because that works. Right.
I got one last comment here. I used to work at Google, and I still have some contacts there who will leak information to me now and then. And apparently Google takes the Intel Management Engine stuff, which in and of itself is absolutely fascinating in a horrifying way. They're taking it seriously enough. They've essentially revived a project from the 90s. If anyone remember the Free BIOS project, they're writing replacement BIOSes for the millions and millions of servers they have in their various data centers around the world to completely replace the stock BIOS with a supposedly going to be free and open source BIOS for all their machines, which they're going to put out there for anyone else to use who has compatible motherboards. So, nice. Yeah.
There's another way we can take that question, though, which I think might be fun for the panel, which is ignoring the part about governments. Where is the next place that we might expect to see a bug with the impact that Spectre and Meltdown have had? I mean,
oh, right. Oh.
Yeah.
I'd say also another nice. Another target. I'm biased because I love web application security, but look at last year in Struts with the Struts vulnerability in Equifax.
Last week too, right?
And last week, that's exactly right. You know, remote code execution through their website. You know, 150 million consumers' private information was stolen through Equifax because of a open source bug that, like Xavier had said, had been there for a while, and they were just secretly using it in the background. So, and then it became a zero day.
Well, let's think more fun. Who remembers what was the movie Sneakers? You know. You want to crash a plane? How about taking down or holding the FAA hostage? How about that on a busy travel holiday weekend? How about that? We've heard about the Russians and possibly the Chinese getting into the power grid and power stations and even nuclear power stations. How about 15, 20, 30 Chernobyls across the U.S. all at once?
But
how about that?
But what's happening is so uninteresting. That the money to be made is mining Monero, right? Right? So now everything is hacked. But what are they doing? They're just sitting there burning up our CPU.
Right.
They're charging us more like power bill. I mean, you know, so yes, the world is hacked, but they're just mining Bitcoin and Monero.
On Cisco routers,
on IoT devices, on doorbells. I mean, oh no. So is everybody going to say, who cares, right? But I mean, as soon as they say, "Well, that's not profitable anymore," so they say, "Okay, we're going to change back to doing destructive stuff, like you know, holding the Atlanta City hostage and whatnot." So, I get this a whole lot. You know, the system. Oh yeah, we don't have to take off that server offline. It's just got Monero bit mining on it. I'm like, okay, that doesn't have an attacker on our servers. Yeah, no, we need to take that.
You know, and actually, the attack vectors, I guess now to answer the question is it's everywhere, right? Because with mobile apps these days, and Jay could probably speak more to that, but like just, I think it was this week, Air Canada got hacked, their mobile app, and they were able to steal passport numbers from users. That just came out because their mobile app was doing stupid shit. And so mobile is another target also.
All right, I'm going to declare that we've rambled on too long, but it was a good question, and we can come back to this after midnight. There was a woman over here who had a question I believe was next. Do you remember what your question was?
I don't.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
Such a good answer for that one,
We will do this. So
give her another drink.
Feel free, if you've got a question that you really want us to answer, you know, don't just raise your hand. You can jump up and down and really get our attention and be obnoxious. That's fine.
Hashtag #hacking201. You can tweet it to us. How about that?
You go ahead, and then we'll get you next.
Could you tell us some of your favorite passwords that you use?
So I literally
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, same as my luggage.
So in the let's see here, this not 90, late 90s, I did one of those, you know, worked for one of those companies. Was like, hey, come get your MCSE and become an IT guy, right? Come, you know, it was a company that allowed a lot of people to learn IT and big boom. It was Microsoft, mainly Microsoft courses, and I was the IT manager there. And all the Microsoft classes there, they set up all the individuals, they used the password, capital P at SSW 0RD. Now, that is one of my favorite passwords because it works in even if you've got the advanced thing on AD where you've got the password complexity. That's a complex password. So that's so you ask me, that's my favorite password is that one. So.
I do
favorite password.
That is my favorite password.
Hey, this is my first Dragon Con, so it's awesome.
Some
tech.
Yeah.
So we haven't scared you away.
Awesome.
No, this is amazing.
So my question is kind of more advice and sort of career related. I work for a security consulting firm that I will leave unnamed.
Wise decision.
I sort of have a trouble since I was the intern and no one takes me seriously now that I'm full-time, that security controls and things that I try to help the company implement, the same things that they advise our clients to do, are things that we don't do at the office. And so it's very frustrating, and I would just like some advice, I guess. Thank you.
Security for your company doesn't make them money.
Yeah.
I worked for a couple.
As another thing, like I turned two-factor on for office, and there was so much screeching in the office that we had four meetings about why we should never turn on two-factor authentication. So,
personally, document everything and cover your ass so you're not the scapegoat when things blow up.
Yeah. One of the things is as I've had different positions in the ladder, and as I've had different positions higher up in the ladder, those are sales jobs. When I was a VP, when I was a director, I was generally trying to sell people on my security ideas. And so, you know, my history as being an actual sales, you know, on the sales team, I realized that that's what my job was as a security VP was selling people. And so, if you can get good at that, you've got yourself a career path, right? It's not the security for security's sake. It is security to enable technology, right? Why am I turning this two-factor on? If they are fussing about the extra added friction there, then that you haven't sold it, and you have to sell the security solution for people to buy it to deal with the extra trouble because they understand the reason for doing it.
All right, we forgot when we were starting up, there's a crypto challenge that, contest that's been going on all weekend, and we have winners and results to announce. So my apologies. Let's go ahead and take care of that. You doing that? Okay,
yeah.
I thought Scott was doing that. Okay, never mind. You need a mic? Got a mic here.
So this weekend, we were running a crypto challenge. We had 10 beginner and 10 advanced puzzles. We had 58 teams, 39 in answering in the beginner and 12 in the advanced. Team Butts, Joe Still, are you here?
Team Butts. Say it proud. Team Butts. Woo!
There you go. All 10 out of 10. He beat Team Crypto Knights by about an hour in solving.
Nice. Good job. Congratulations. Hype that up and put it on your resume.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the events challenge, it was a little tougher. We had 12 teams. Crypto Knights, Fu Thong, and your team come up first place. They got 9 out of 10 puzzles.
Woo! Crypto Knights! Woo!
He's even wearing a tie.
So this is the second year they've won.
Ooh.
So you got 9 out of 10. I'll have a little tougher puzzles next year because
Yes. So second year that you've won, maybe you guys should write the puzzles for next year and give someone else a chance.
So if anybody's here for the crypto challenge and is curious about some of the solutions, I'll be back off to the side. I know you're really curious about number 9.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Yeah, for you new folks here or for people who don't participate in the crypto challenges, they're a lot of fun. Most conventions have them now. Definitely check them out. They're educational. You will definitely learn something even if you're not the grand prize winner. So highly recommended. I've written a few myself and solved far fewer. All right. I believe gentleman over here had a question, and actually I've got one for you real quick. You want to try hacking my phone again or rooting my phone again?
Same, it's the same one as last year that you couldn't get into.
I probably won't be able to. I don't really do that much Android stuff these days.
It's not because it's like super secure or anything. It's because it's so damn old and slow that his software times out on it.
Who's the maker?
HTC.
Is that HTC?
It's an old Samsung. It's like 7 years old or something. Yeah. Oh, God, no. No, even I'm not that bad.
Firefox Mobile?
No.
Take the Facebook phone.
Yeah, good for you.
I just want to make and receive phone calls on. I don't care about the rest.
Exactly.
All right. You got a question?
I forgot what it was.
Go for it.
I stole this fair and square.
That's fine. Whoever holds the box gets to ask the questions.
So social engineering is near and dear to my heart.
Oh, mine too.
I've gotten into Dragon Con for free. I've gotten into the artist alley at Tomorrow World a couple times because I work in sales. So I don't. But
we'll talk later about the VIP pass I managed to obtain 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, two-pronged question. One, what is the best way to make this my job? Like, I would be the happiest person if I could do this, like, full-time. Because nobody suspects that I know anything about technology.
Do we have red team people here? Okay. Yeah, raise your hands again, and she will collect business cards from you.
Please. But what I wanted to ask you guys is, if you guys have any of that experience, what's your favorite social engineering story that you have to tell?
Yes.
So, to answer your first question, there are companies have red teams, especially if they are consumer-based companies that have, storefronts or anything. The idea is go and hack the stores, right? And so there's teams that they fly around and they go, and so just about any, corporation has one of those teams, and there's a few in Atlanta. Like I said, there's people here, including myself, that can help you.
Okay.
I think I went over most of my social engineering stuff in my intro, and to this day, probably my favorites are somehow getting into a position of authority here at Dragon Con for over a decade, and hosting the radio show when I had no business being in the station for almost a decade.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyone else?
I've got one of my social engineering fails. I was doing a physical pen test in a hospital. And this hospital happened to be right next to a government facility in which they take apart nuclear weapons. So the hospital itself was not. I mean, it was not hacking a military site. But when you live in a town like that, you gotta have that mentality, right? So the head of radiology walked by and saw me sitting in a room by myself, typing away, and said, excuse me? Who are you? And I'm like, I work for GE Medical. I'm here working on this PET scanner. We're upgrading the firmware. We got it's looking pretty good. And
where's Bowie?
Sorry. Hey, he looked at me and said, yeah, I'm the head of radiology. I would have known if GE Medical is going to be here today. I'm like, all right, so actually my real story is I am hired by, so it was your CISO that hired GE Medical to then do some TIN testing, who actually outsourced it to this other company that I work for that actually outsourced it to me because I'm an independent consultant. And okay, here's my, get out of jail free card, right? All right, so I had the paper. And it explains what I'm doing, and so he takes me back to his office, and he goes to call the people on the paper. The problem is that there was a birthday in the office.
Oh, God.
And nobody was there.
Oh, no.
So it's fallen flat. And so I have an MP standing right behind me as the, and just kind of getting antsy, really wants to put those cuffs on me, and they finally came back from that birthday party at lunch and cleared me out. But I mean, I was this close from getting booked up. So
my best one is only the best because I ran it for like every weekend for 5 years, which is essentially that I would go to clubs, and I'm gonna date myself in telling this story, but I would go to clubs and wait for the DJs to be coming in, and they'd have like crates of their records. And I would just I would walk up to the DJ and be like, hey, do you need help carrying the crate? And then I'd grab it, they'd be like, yeah, sure, help us. I'd grab the crate, go to the bouncer, and be like, I'm with the DJ, I'm kind of helping carry his crates. And got into every club in New York City, for 5 years, every weekend, until they finally hired me to promote professionally, but like, yeah, so it had nothing to do with tech, but just like, this is how clubs work. And
so now I'm wondering if you want to get into a club that's difficult to get into, if you can just snag a milk crate from somewhere and a bunch of cheap albums, you know.
Well, the problem is now DJs are using CDJs and Serato, and so no one actually has
not if you're
records.
Not if you're cool. Not if you're cool.
Okay, now wait a minute. If the club DJs aren't using the records anymore, then who the hell's buying all the vinyl that's come back at the
print? Hipsters.
Really?
Singing in hipster bars.
Really? Hanging on the wall. Damn hipsters ruin everything, man. Done that, yeah.
Last thing,
is
he okay?
He's fine. He's resting.
He's compiling Pearl.
This is not the first rodeo for any of us, so we're good. So, Lady Death, yes, ma'am.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Oh, wait, who's got the box? I'm sorry, you've got the box. I'm sorry, I'm breaking my own rules. Yeah. Go ahead and then you, Lady Death.
Please.
All right, so my question was, I was reading like 4 years ago on Cory Doctorow's blog, there was some laws coming into effect where it was like illegal to report hardware vulnerabilities in the United States of America, and I was wondering, what's the status of that? Is that still true? Is there still legality issues about reporting security vulnerabilities? That seemed insane to me, so.
I think that's plus something that was made, this kind of answers the social engineering question too. We got the most amazing thing 4 years ago. There's this thing called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Like it's the law we all love to hate, which basically makes revealing anything that can be used to do copyright infringement, just revealing the technology or distributing the technology, can be a crime. And that makes reverse engineering software, among other things, effectively really, really illegal. The Copyright Office, every 3 years, does a review of requests for exemptions from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Right. We put in a request for an exemption for good faith security research, defined broadly. So if you're doing good faith security research and you're not actually trying to infringe copyrights, you can, you know, and you should read the text and contact a lawyer if you're not sure, but you can be covered under this exemption from the DMCA. Right. And it is just, the social engineering part of this was the voting machine companies forgot to show up at the hearings. When the hearings happened, we managed to convince the Copyright Office that the original request was for consumer products. And we managed to convince the Copyright Office that voting machines, because consumers use them to vote, are consumer products. And we got voting machines explicitly covered under this. So, anyway, fortunately, right now the news is better than it ever has been on reporting vulnerabilities and looking for them.
Thank you, sir.
I was just gonna say for the, well, I guess it's not really social engineering, but just one of the things where you see a vulnerability and I wonder what's gonna go on with that. And it's the hospital that's nearest my house, and my son had to go in and get several different imaging, and each time we had to go into the room, you know, for them to run insurance and everything, I mean, I just watched the back of the computer, because it was a kind of an all-in-one, and like there was just everything. There was the Ethernet port, there were like USBs, everything. And so the second time we were there, I'm not gonna say the software because probably shouldn't use it, but I just stuck in a small USB just to see
Rubber ducky.
I didn't do anything bad with it, but you could have, for sure, because give me all the patient records. everything. So a lot of it is just, you know, vulnerabilities of just
there's a lot of stuff
open.
There's a lot of stuff that's stupidly exposed like that. Please don't ever do that again unless you're pen testing, because even if you don't do anything, someone could get a bug up their ass and really make life very difficult for you for a long time.
It's true, and I work for a tech company and could have problems there. And that's my, I guess, second question is, work for a major tech company, I work from home, we've got the, you know, secure VSP, everything else, but several times I've been able to, just kind of in downtime, find things that I probably shouldn't be able to find, and report those within the company, and nothing gets fixed. Whereas if you reported it maybe as a like bug find or something like that, it would get fixed. And so I don't know if anybody has experience with those type of things.
Responsible vulnerability disclosure, would that be?
Well, like, you know, I'm thinking more on the, like, the corporate side, right? So you're finding corporate vulnerabilities. And I don't know what's happening. It could be falling into a black hole and nobody's doing anything about it. Or it could be, you know, being logged in a system. You know, a lot of companies use Arbor to as a tool to kind of, you know, categorize those vulnerabilities found and assess their risk. And then they decide, you know, there's several things you could do with risk, and one of them is you can fix the problem, you mitigate the risk, or you can accept the risk and look at it to see if the cost of fixing it is too much. You can decide you want to, you know, go and fix the risk. And so it might be a situation in which they're looking at it thinking that is something that we, you know, would like to fix, but we've got other fish to fry, and we need to mitigate this other risk. We've only got so many, you know, people to do it, and so we're going to go fix the really bad stuff, and we'll get to this other stuff eventually. So I don't know if that's the case in your situation. I just know that, you know, I've worked on that side, and there it might seem like nothing's getting fixed, and it might just be that there's, you know, even worse stuff out there that they're working on. So.
What you may want to do, and this has kind of saved my ass in several jobs, is keep just kind of like a notepad daily work log, and if you find stuff like this, note, found this in course of my job, reported it to such and such. And that way, again, you're covering your ass and making sure that if shit goes down, you're not the scapegoat. The ringing sound there, that's... Yeah, you may want to, like, when the only bring the box up when the question is being asked, and then bring it back down. Maybe not even all the way, but just 50%. So, go for it.
I have a fun story, if that's allowed.
Fun stories are always allowed.
So, unclassified cyber event, all fun, right? Everyone, you have your DNS beacon.
Can you all hear in the back?
Bring the box up. Okay, yeah, sorry. So, unclassified cyber event, all good and fun. So, red team. Of course you want to do DNS beacons because that's the most fun. So create the beacon, and we thought, oh, we'll just use the domain name that we use like on our fun real Amazon instance, because it's all off net, no big deal, until one of the teams reports it up the chain, and somebody tries to decode the malware on a off-game network and lights up a three-letter agency's computer for connecting to our Amazon beacon.
Yeah.
Fun.
Oh dear. It's all fun and games until the handcuffs get slapped on.
I know I can't ask for beer, but she would like a drink.
I'll allow that on a technicality just this once, because you're asking for someone else. So there you go. Clever hack. The cups are interesting, so you may have to take more than one. Yeah, they are.
They really are interesting.
I'm wondering if there might be super glue involved.
Yeah, whatever happens. So last year we had a conversation at this same panel about ethical responsibility. And the whole conversation devolved into the fundamental flaw in Cisco routers that could have brought down the internet.
I'm so sorry. I don't think we heard you up here. So
sure.
Reset. Okay.
Hey, come on. Guys, ask me a question.
I give up. I don't know what's going on here.
Last year we had a conversation about ethical responsibility and devolved into the fundamental flaw in Cisco routers that could have fundamentally destroyed the internet or disabled the internet for a great period of time, and what that led to, and a man who quit his job and passed out resumes and had a whole conversation.
I know exactly who you're talking about because that guy was my roommate.
And you told the story last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I did. Okay.
Yeah. Has there been so that was a phenomenal story about somebody who did the right thing at the right time, protected by the right people. Given a situation like that, you could relate to us.
I'm sorry. What exactly was the question again? I know who you're talking about. What are you asking me to relay the story again?
No, another situation where there was somebody did the right thing in terms of identifying a hack to the right people at the right time. Maybe it was DEFCON or, you know, but okay. As opposed to directly to Cisco, but like did the right thing and it worked out because they had a fundamental responsibility to do so, or at least they thought they did.
He's asking for big damn hero stories, like super white hat stories,
yeah.
And he's referencing Mike Lynn and Cisco Gate, Black Hat 2005.
Yeah,
so anyone got good ones you want to go for?
Oh,
see. Can you tell the same story again? There's a whole bunch of new guys.
Yeah. You tell it.
They're doing it here
from the beginning. And there's the SB315 story,
too. All right. I'll do that, and Mike, if you hear this at some point, I apologize, and whenever you tell me to stop telling the story, I'll stop telling the story. So, lived with this guy who worked for ISS, and I was working for a web hosting company at the time. This is the porno web hosting company, by the way, but that's another story for later, interesting tales there. And I had started working on some Cisco certifications because this was about the time I was beginning to realize my employers were really scary sleazebags. And, yeah, well, stories later. So I had several 2500 series routers, and I was also downloading Junos images for Juniper stuff. And fun aside, if you're doing networking, particularly router certification, Cisco's main rival is Juniper Networks. Juniper stuff is built on x86 hardware, so you can get something as old as a Pentium 3 class machine, load an older version of FreeBSD on it as far back as 2.6, and then load a Junos image as a package, and when the computer reboots, it'll think it's a $40,000 Juniper in-class router, so you can basically build a Juniper routing lab off of throwaway hardware. It's pretty cool. I'll talk about that later. Anyway, Mike wanted to play with the Cisco stuff because he hadn't played with any yet, and I had some routers I weren't using, wasn't using for service. I was like, yeah, sure, knock yourself out. And the son of a bitch did not tell me that he was reverse engineering iOS at ISS, and I didn't realize at the time, apparently in the 2004-2005 era, I don't know if it's still like this, the way the InfoSec community worked was kind of like, as Mike says, kind of like the mafia. You know, they would do clean room reverse engineering on stuff, or officially clean room reverse engineering, and then go to the companies and say, yeah, you know, we found this big flaw in your hardware. Sure would be a shame if someone released a script kiddie tool to exploit this, wouldn't it? You want to pay us for the research and the fix? Sure you do. So, yeah, he found some interesting stuff in Cisco routers, and he found some scary stuff in Cisco routers. And at the time, this was during the Bush and Cheney administration, and through no-bid contracts, about 95% of the federal government, U.S. federal government, military, and including intelligence community back-end infrastructure was mandated to be Cisco gear. And so this left a lot of shit really vulnerable, and Mike was bumping up against some pretty well-funded Chinese groups that were also kind of playing the same territory that he was. And the flaw that he found, now he had to recant all this later because lawyers, but in my humble opinion, based on what happened afterwards, I think that was a face-saving legal fix from Cisco, and I'll explain why in a moment, i.e. fucking bullshit. The flaw that Mike found was claimed at the time could have been exploited to allow not just remote code execution on Cisco routers, think about that, but the creation of a Cisco router virus, which could have propagated globally in about 15 minutes.
because your routing table is right there. You know immediately where to go to. And I was working at, I went from sleazy pornographers to Google afterwards, and they were mostly Juniper stuff, which is where I really got into Juniper. But I also got to play with some high-end Cisco stuff. And if you haven't played with the higher-end routers, the router equivalent of a PC's BIOS, it's pretty much it's a chip soldered directly onto the board. And if something goes wrong, like if you corrupt your firmware, you basically just get a new product shipped to you. They ship hardware. You don't try to fix it in-house. You know, you send the other stuff back and Cisco techs work on it, blah, blah, blah. And what Mike realized, if you create a Cisco, if you really want to destroy the internet for a while, good long while, you could create your Cisco router virus, have it propagate globally, and once the a router couldn't find any uninfected neighbors next to it, it would scramble the firmware and reboot. Think about that. You'll still have isolated segments up that are based on non-Cisco gear, but how are you gonna get a fix? You can't download a fix, the internet's gone. You're gonna have to physically ship product. UPS, FedEx, and the post office, even back then, were all depending on the internet being there to route and ship things, and it's not just the tech companies. Think about coordinating food to grocery stores, gas to gas stations. Yeah, it would have been pretty fucking bad, and so Mike realized this was really serious. And the ISS people were like, jackpot, gold mine, dollar signs, and this was gonna be the keynote talk at Black Hat of 2005, I believe. And Cisco even approved it. They sent their research to Cisco. Cisco was gonna send one of their engineers out. They were all gonna present this talk together. I guess one of the C-level folks at Cisco realized a couple days before Black Hat slash DEF CON, holy shit, you know, we can't do this. And so then the guerrilla letters went out. And you can actually still find videos online because ISS and Black Hat slash DEF CON caved. Think about that. And you can find videos of the temps that Cisco sent out to physically rip pages out of the program booklets, which had already been printed out, and theoretically to remove the CDs that came with the program booklets that had the presentation on it and break them. And
I was a goon that year.
I love the video because you can see some of the DEF CON Black Hat people filming these attempts they sent in to do this stuff. They're like, is your IT career everything you imagined it would be? Are you making anything more than minimum wage? You got any benefits? And of course, this was ridiculous because the pages that were torn out of the books, most of them apparently were not shredded. So, you know, dumpster diving, people got garbage bags filled with this stuff, scanned immediately on the net. Most of the
check CDs it on eBay.
Yeah, most of the CDs apparently were not broken. And think about it, the publishers had the printers had the information, the CD manufacturers had the information. I mean, this stuff was everywhere, so it's not like they prevented anything from leaking. Mike was told by ISS that he could not talk about remote code execution on Cisco routers. He'd have to talk about voice over IP or something like that because Cisco was going to sue everybody into oblivion. So, keynote talk for Black Hat 2005. Room is packed. People are waiting out in the hallways to see what's going to happen. Mike comes in and says, well, I guess you know what I was supposed to talk about. My employer said that I'm not allowed to do that. I'm going to have to talk about voice over IP. Crowd boos. He says, hang on a minute. Disappears behind the podium. He comes back up. Honest to God, he's wearing a giant white cowboy hat that says good across the front. He said, that's why I quit my job with ISS an hour ago. I have a stack of resumes here. I will need a lawyer by the time this talk is done. Let's talk about remote code execution on Cisco routers. And he actually, as an aside, he had called me up the night before the talk, and he said, I know you have every weird image on the internet on your computer. I'm going to give you a list of what I need. And it was like, yep, got it. Okay, do you need an atomic explosion over a city? Do you need day or night shot? Do you need, like, dead bodies in the foreground? I got a lot of nuke photos. You got to be more. Yeah, so, hobby. So he gives his talk, and the woohoo! I'll let you set those up. No. I'm telling stories, so I'll let you set those up. So anyway, he gives the talk. Thunderous applause. The goons escorted the audience out to clear the room for the next talk. And this is how Mike told it to me, and I believe him. He's a good guy.
and said he realized the room was being cleared out and there were a couple of guys who were kind of monopolizing his attention. He figured they were feds because, you know, they had the ex-military build and the Hawaiian t-shirts and the shorts and the short hair and blah, blah, blah. And then he realized everyone else is gone and just me and these two guys. And they said, okay, Mr. Lin, you need to come with us. And they got on either side of him and put an arm on his bicep and started walking him out of the room. And when he gets out of the room, he said the hall had been cleared. There was nobody in the hallway. And that's when he began going, oh, shit. And they walk him down the hallway to a employee corridor, service corridor, and go out onto a loading dock. And he said, Drew, my knees were shaking. And get out onto the loading dock, and there were three other guys out there. And one of them, who he assumed was the boss guy, said, is that him? And one of the guys holding him and said, yeah. The boss guy says, okay, put the hood on his head and bring the van around. And he said he nearly fell down and apparently turned so white, they all started laughing, came up to him, started shaking his hands and giving him cards. I'm from the CIA, I'm from the DIA, I'm from the NRO, I'm from the, Mr. Lin, you have some challenge coins, you've done a great service to your country, we had no idea this vulnerability existed, phone calls are being made now, we're going to give you advice on how to stay out of the hands of the FBI until we can get you in front of a judge on a Sunday. And, so he went in front of the judge and said, I kind of exaggerated some of this. I'm so sorry, Cisco. That night, when he had given the talk, I think this is kind of amusing, Cisco flew their CEO, CIO, and CFO on one of their private jets out to Washington, D.C. to talk to Cheney's people, not W's. I thought that was funny, but there's a Halliburton connection there. And even though Mike recanted and had admitted he had exaggerated a bit, Juniper Networks, who at the time was Cisco's main rival, but they were a tiny sliver of the market, snatched him up 2 weeks later, made him their chief security engineer, had him sign, in Mike's words, a sign of NDAs 20 feet high, gave him the source code to everything, and said, make sure we're not vulnerable like Cisco is, and then teach our engineers how to do what you do. And he still, he lives in D.C. now, and he still apparently goes to the Pentagon several times a year to talk to people about secret stuff I'll never know about. So, Mike Lin, American hero. And Mike, this is a story, if you're listening to this at some point, this is a story, as I remember it, that you told it to me, so I will correct anything that's wrong, and if you want me to stop telling it, I'll stop telling it. So, there we go. I don't remember, I'm not sure if that answers the question that was asked, but I hope that was an entertaining, excuse me. Oh, you want something that's a little bit lower level than that, yeah. So, has anyone got something that's a step down from Mike Lin level?
Yeah, I was thinking about when you talk about the story is when it doesn't go just right? When it didn't.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, is let me pull it back up here. Get the right names and dates. But basically, a guy got an iPad and 3G iPad and went to go sign up for it through AT&T. And noticed that when he did so, he had to put in his email address, and there's this ICC ID, and that you could see it in the browser. And he's like, huh. So what happens if I were to increment that number? And oh look, there's somebody else's email address. Huh. So okay, and then I'm just gonna write a little script here. And just to show that I can, that this is a vulnerability, and to go tell AT&T. Well, especially, went and tried to tell the AT&T this. Now, I don't know the inside story here. This is a lot of just, at the time. Does anybody have inside information on this one? This is Daniel Spittler and Ottenheimer. What's funny is that when it got out to Gawker, because that's where you go to do responsible distribution, is that they called themselves Goatsy Security.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember Goatsy Security.
Yeah, Goatsy Security. If you're new, you can... You can.
Let's see the newbies. Go ahead and Google Goatsy.
Let me spell it for you. It's G-O-A-T-S-E. So just go ahead.
We want to wait for the reaction shot.
We're going to need the projector. Is that turned on?
That's after midnight. After midnight.
I don't even want to know.
That's the millennial.
The porno people I worked for at one point hosted Tub Girl.
All right.
High squat in. That's hot.
So anyway, basically AT&T was not entertained by this. And sent their lawyers out and actually arrested this dude. His crime was he did run the script and got a number of you know, a large number. It's like, you know, 10,000 or something to just show that the script worked. And that's what it was. It was a script to download a bunch of emails that were the account holders of iPads on this 3G network for AT&T. He got 3.5 years in jail.
Damn. What?
Yep. This was in 2013. And so it doesn't always go right. So there's always, you think that you're in the right, this is just a vulnerability, we need to be able to, you know, let information be free, but it doesn't always go right.
But that story did have a somewhat happy ending.
Go ahead and finish it up for me.
On appeal, Third Circuit found that the venue that he was prosecuted under was not the correct venue, and the conviction was...
eventually returned. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So and they never retried him. But so you know, and weirdly he chose not to try to be out of jail while his appeal was pending. So he spent time inside, but he was ultimately the conviction was ultimately.
So is he like working with Kevin Mitnick now?
No. He is a loathsome person, but he did not belong in jail for that particular thing.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if that was the thing that started, but I believe tinkering with URLs and fuzzing in that sense, just in your own browser, is theoretically illegal. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, we don't know, right? I mean, in no sensible way was he doing something that that anyone who understands the intent of the law would say that, you know, entering a URL is not, you know, breaking into a computer. You know, you're just getting what the URL is sending you, you're asking for. It's really, other than this case, it's never been tested, and it was thrown out on grounds other than that, right? They threw it out on venue, which court he was tried in, not on the fundamental issue. So it was a kind of unsatisfying
ending.
All right, for everyone who's already asked a good question, we have a lot of good refreshing beverages for you there, so feel free. And, you got the box, but you got your hand up, so fight, Thunderdome.
Whoa.
It's about to come out.
I thought you passed it around.
It's a little premature.
You got an Audi.
Oh, yeah, that's already been asked. Sorry, man. Yeah, too late. So, no, his question's done, so we can actually go back to you. And I'm going to let one of y'all moderate for the next few minutes because, coffee and booze, you never really buy them. You just rent them for a little bit. So I'll be right back.
Did you have a question?
I forgot.
Guys. Write it down on the person in front of you.
You get a drink if you forgot your question?
Remember, he's asked an earlier question.
So I've got a Pearl story.
Is he still awake down there?
Oh, man. So our red team was breaking into our systems, and they came upon this horrible thing called an AIX server.
Yes.
And they like, it doesn't have Python. I don't know what to do. I said, it has Perl. What is Perl? Yeah, so.
What is Pearl?
What is Pearl? What is it? This is my red. You know, so now this guy is now a junior red team, and he is, he's been, you know, thoroughly demoted.
Yes.
But I also had to teach him how to, like, use VI, not VIM. VI on AIX to try to, you know, I think all he had to do was, like, put it, to, you know, drop in, like, an HTML to prove that he got in there or something. It was just sad. Yeah. All right. We got questions?
Question?
Okay. Basically, you were talking about setting up free BIOS, essentially creating another one. Wouldn't it be better to have at least like several competing BIOSes spread around so that you don't have a problem like you did with the single Cisco router systems everywhere, so that you find one bug and it crashes everything?
Well, that's what we have now. Is we have, you know, the only, you know, BIOS is you go to the manufacturer and you have to get that BIOS, and it's not open source, and so, you know, Web of Trust.
Right, but I'm trying to say is, wouldn't even if you go for a free BIOS, for a single open source BIOS, wouldn't it be better to have actually several competing open source BIOSes that have different people working on them and different focuses on development and stuff to try and diversify, give yourself a genetic diversity, so to speak.
Give you more vulnerabilities.
Yeah. Well, you're going to get different vulnerabilities, though, so one thing isn't going to be able to get all of them, is my argument.
Yes, but we got to start one. We don't even have the open source BIOS, so we got to start with the first one, and then we'll get the you know, several of them out. So we got right behind you.
Isn't the open source one Libreboot, right? Are people familiar with Libreboot? Yes? No?
I'm not
Libra.
Libra.
Sir in the back? Goth? Yes? Toss it. Put an eye out.
In the corporate world, it looks like a lot of companies are starting to move from on-prem to the cloud, whether it be hosted on any of the cloud providers. Or, you know, they could be moving to a SaaS solution or a PaaS solution. It's just taking this entire data center that belongs to these huge companies and giving it to Oracle, giving it to Amazon. What are some big security risks that they should be looking out for?
So I'll refer you to my 27-deck slide that I was not allowed to present. No, actually presented on cloud security at DEF CON, both in Sky Talks and Blue Team Village on this. So it's a, you know, I speak for an hour on, like, cloud security. One, there's not just cloud. Two, the, you know, just saying cloud security is just, it's just huge, right? Cloud is lots of things. But here's the thing is that there's people think the cloud is just running a server on somebody else's network, right? I'm just to run a virtual server, right? I can then SSH to it, RDT to it, and I've got this server, and it's somebody else is hosting it. That is yesterday's cloud. That's like millennials cloud. You know, now the new cloud is as a service. Is just, I want a database as a service. I would like a LDAP as a service. I don't have servers to put agents on. And there's so many of our security, you know, infrastructure out there that we assume that we can just throw an agent on it and we can, you know, do all of these things. And the problem is the diversity of what the cloud is. And when you build cloud native applications and cloud native infrastructure, that we are now migrating back from, you know, like throw an agent and have this security stack on all of our servers to now we've got to go back and do stuff on the network. And some of it applies here and some applies there. And it is quite scattered, and so yes, there's a lot of stuff there, and you're not going to be able to apply all the same security controls across the board just because of all the new, you know, blank as a service crap that we've got to deal with. And I don't know if anybody else has got something to jump in with cloud security.
So earlier Meltdown Inspector were brought up. These are just extremely fundamental bugs in the CPUs that we're working with. They allow for being able to read arbitrary memory essentially from different processes if you have even the ability to sort of talk to them. And when I say different processes, I also include different processes running on different operating systems running under the same hypervisor on a virtual, on like Xen. And so what we've been seeing is that these bugs have actually applied to shared hosting providers and cloud providers. So you end up in the scenario where when you're running on virtualized cloud hardware, that when there are 0 days that come out like this, the cloud provider ends up scrambling for potentially weeks trying to figure out how they're going to reboot these machines and do all their upgrades. And with Meltdown and Spectre, we've been seeing just a chain of these bugs. I mean, just every few weeks, we find another side channel exploit that is related to this set of bugs. And so, I mean, there's another one just a couple weeks ago, which was the L1 cache related bug. And And so, and so I'm pretty certain that you can expect to see more of these in the future. So,
anybody else do? I took my degree in computer engineering. Anybody else chip design? Every time I hear about all the vulnerabilities and learn how Spectre works and all these, I think back to my CompB professor that said, you know, it's all about RISC processors and how those are like this Intel assholes don't know anything, right? If they, yeah, RISC processors, so much better architecture and whatnot. And as I hear all of these vulnerabilities coming up about the x86 architectures, I'm just like, oh my God, I bet you that professor is just loving it. You'd be like, all right, PowerPC, let's do it. Is it? I thought that I didn't think the RISC had the predicted branch. Did RISC do a predicted branch? I thought that was an x86. No? All right. I just been out. I was not in the 90s when I did chip design. I went into security, so.
Good choice.
This is rather broad, but I started coding back when SQLi was on, 9 out of 10 servers, and I've since joined the working force and work on open source frameworks. And I wanted to know what your thoughts were on responsible disclosure on open source frameworks, things like, so Django had like a big exploit like 3 years ago. We're like, oh, use a factory class and you should cap it at 5,000 because you can pass a query parameter to have it at 10,000. That's an easy DOS. What is your thoughts on responsible disclosure in the open source world?
Just tweet it.
I don't want to do that, man.
That will get people's attention.
Yeah. So
I can tell you that's hot right now, right? Because everybody's using open source and their mobile apps and such, and there's a lot of companies jumping in on that now, like Sonatype or Black Duck, that are really big right now, and they analyze open source code for vulnerabilities. So I don't have much to offer other than that, but it's just as important where people, again, they pull in libraries and they don't know what's vulnerable. We look at source code all the time. Right. So companies submit their source code to us and they just submit the libraries for those open source projects, and we don't see the code, so we don't know exactly what's happening in there.
Do you think you can cover your ass by using a third party library?
No.
Oh no. when your company gets raped because you had it in your app, it doesn't matter if it's third party or your code, you're the one that's going to be in the press that said you just got hacked.
Because you use someone else's code.
Exactly.
If you think about if it's an active supported module or something, go. We've got GitHub. We've got, you open up an issue, talk to them. You can, generally, those groups are a lot more approachable than, like a Microsoft or Cisco, right? And so you should be able to do, responsible, disclosure with them. And if an open source group treats you like Microsoft does and just says, then that's a different situation. But, And also, if it's not supported, that's another, if it's an old new module that everybody still kind of uses and kicks around, that there's not really any active development on it, that might be another issue.
Can I just put in my plug for just what an utterly terrible term responsible disclosure is, right? I mean, first of all, responsible according to who?
Right.
Who are you trying to be responsible to protect? In the case of something where there's, you discover something, that's something you figured out, you've got the question, well, what do I do with it? You should be responsible. Everyone should be responsible in everything they do, all the time. right? You know, this is this obligation to be responsible doesn't suddenly come up then. You know, a reasonable thing to do is to say, you know, let's try to get this fixed quietly before people start exploiting it. That's not always going to be possible, right? You have, might have multiple places where the same bug appears. There might be an identical vulnerability somewhere else that you might have discovered something more fundamental than even you think it was. And so, you know, this isn't, you know, there's no formula on this. And, you know, in the case where it's open source, you know, it adds a couple of wrinkles to it. But I think every single disclosure case is complicated and has to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis.
I mean, and in Georgia, we have an example right here of where someone responsibly reported a vulnerability in the election system and the way the election data was being maintained, responsibly reported it. And we, rather than reward him or even say thank you, is reported to the feds. The feds said there's no law broken here, and the state said, let's create a law. Let's make that illegal. And the brilliant work of EF Georgia and other local groups were the only reason that that didn't get signed into law by the governor, right? And so.
And while we're on ethical disclosure, don't get me started on responsible disclosure. Don't get me started on ethical hacker, right? I mean, you know, be ethical. Of course,
certified.
You should be ethical. Everyone, you know, I don't call myself a non-murderous professor. Right?
But you do now. That's now on your card. Yeah.
There's the master key exploits for Android that were found by Jeff Forrestal, like the class of exploits. I end up getting a lot of credit for them because what happened is that Jeff Forrestal actually, he's really in responsible disclosure. And he, whether or not, I don't really understand the truth behind a lot of this, but he always, what all of his marketing material about him says that he was responsible for the first responsible disclosure policy. And so when he found the master key vulnerabilities, he disclosed them to Google. And as far as I can tell, got strung along for a while. I even had a chance to talk to him about it because there were like a sequence of bugs that ended up being found that ended up causing the entire responsible disclosure pathway that they had set up to just start falling apart. But so the reason I bring up this story is that he then mentioned that he had found a bug. He didn't explain what the bug was. He simply mentioned that there was this bug and that it allowed you to do this. And what it said, all it was is that there is a bug that allows you to take any Android app signature and use it as your own. Now, that was then announced as there was a talk that was going to be given at Black Hat later that year. And I read the abstract of that talk, and I was like, I want that bug. And just knowing sort of what it did, like, galvanized me to look through that entire region of code line by line and try to figure out whatever all of it did, and I managed to find not one, but two of those bugs. Now, I am certain that tons of other people had found that bug. Like, the issue with responsible disclosure is that you're essentially saying that, like, okay, we're fine because I haven't told anyone what that bug is because, you know, I must be smarter than everyone else, that's why I found the bug. No, it hasn't been reported to anyone yet, but realistically, the bugs were really obvious once I went and looked for them. I just had never bothered looking in that region of the code before. And I didn't need to know what the bug was. I found two. And then my big question was, which one was the one he found? Because I don't want to burn the other one by accident. And so now I had to start going through and trying to, like, poke a little bit around and try to, like, talk to people around him to try to figure out what bug might have been his. And in the process, it was discovered that there was a third bug. And this one was actually announced by somebody on some website. It's like, okay, well, that was neither of the ones that I had found. Yeah, who knows? I mean, there was another one that Jeff Forrestal had found that I did not know about and was not the one that was disclosed, but it wasn't anywhere near as powerful. So I guess at least four. But Jeff Forrestal's bug went through Google, and Google put together a patch for it, and then got that patch through, trying to go through different security vendors in order to get it pushed, and that took forever. And then when the second bug was disclosed, which is not the ones that I had found, but the one from the random party, that one ended up, Google's like, what are we going to do now? Like, okay, so they started, like, scrambling to put through a security one. I ended up releasing the one that Jeff Forrestal had found as, like, a tool once I figured out which one it was. But the one that had been found that was, like, this extra one, what are they going to do about it? And so they ended up actually filing it in Android not as a security bug, but as just a patch, like it's just a bug fix, which then caused it to not get pushed to all of the vendors correctly who were only pulling security bugs, and it never actually ended up on a lot of devices, like the fix for it. And so it's essentially, there was just this massive, like, utter communications failure between all the different parties as they were trying to handle all of their funny little responsible disclosure policies and try to handle all of their special security fix policies. And in the end, Jeff Forstall even felt burned. Because he ended up being on stage at a conference, not announcing any tools that he had built. I was in the front row, and he's like, I was going to do a proof of concept, but Sorek has actually released an end-to-end automated version of not just this bug, but the other bug that was disclosed, and probably soon more. So you should download his tool. It turns out that Google didn't even get the fix in people's hands by the conference, which was months after it got it, because they had filed it as a bug fix, which then caused the various vendors to not get it. The Nexus devices from Google didn't have the original fix from Jeff Forstall, which I got into an argument with the people at Google over this one. I was like, so I've got this Nexus device I bought from you, and I don't have a fix for this bug that I know you found months ago. What's the deal with that? And they started explaining to me that, okay, well, you're supposed to get that fix from your carrier. We got it from your carrier. So I'm like, I bought it from you. I didn't buy it from a carrier. I bought it from you. And then they started explaining they've got this policy where they're not allowed to push fixes to their devices because that would be a public disclosure of the bug until they've gotten it in the hands of the different carriers and given them time to do responsible disclosure through there, and I'm just done with it. Like, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, the Android does that from the hardware manufacturer, and which was then vetted from the specific carrier. So you don't get it directly from Google. You get it from the individual manufacturer. Yeah. And so since I'm just kind of done with it. Like, I'm just to the point where it's just like, if you have a bug and you do not just tell the world about it, no one's going to get a fix for it. Like,
I saw a little bit of this when I worked at Google many years ago, and I imagine the problem's gotten exponentially worse as they've gotten exponentially larger. And the way I like to put it is, the left hand, they're so large now that the left hand never knows which foot the right hand is shooting. So
it's interesting.
To be fair, that's not limited just to Google.
Yeah, you bring up Google. I've actually been on the target, the other end of the gun on that, where Google had found. I work for a software company, security company, and Google had found some software bugs and security bugs on our software, and they were using our software. So there's a reason, you know, that they were looking at it. Their responsible policy was, they said, we found this vulnerability. We classify it as this, and you're going to need to fix this right away. And we said, it's actually not that bad. You know, it's like, it's just this thing. We'll get it, like, in about another quarter. And they're like, no, you need to fix this now. You got 30 days or we're going to, like, you know, do it public. We're like, oh, okay, so I guess we're going to do it now. that ethical, responsible reporting is different when Google's got the gun, and it's quite interesting.
I got to interject one last point.
All right,
if you think like Cisco and Google and big, you know, Microsoft, or you know, pick your least favorite big company, are bad. The non-computer companies are worse. So 15 years ago, I decided I want to like understand more broadly how cryptography relates to other things. So I decided to look at mechanical locks. And so I wrote this, like locks for doors and stuff, right? Not locks for files, right? But you know, so mechanical locks. So I, you know, like learned how locks work. And I learned, in particular, I discovered how do master keyed locks work? Well, how do locks work where there's more than one key for the same door? Figured out that. And then I noticed that if you look at this in mechanical terms, it looks pretty secure. But if you apply like really basic techniques that we would use in cryptography, there's an attack against master keyed locks that just jumps right out at you. And basically it lets you, with the number of pins in the lock, which is like five or six keys that you make, you can convert the key that opens your door to the key that opens all the doors in the building. This has existed, you know, this vulnerability had existed basically since master keying started being a thing 75 years earlier. And so this 75-year-old bug or so in locks. So, you know, I did what any computer scientist would do. I wrote a paper, because I'm a professor type, and I published it in, you know, IEEE Security and Privacy, which, you know, no one reads. And the, except it turns out, then I get a call from John Schwartz of the New York Times who said, that's pretty cool, I'm going to write about it. And it appears, you know, a couple weeks later on page B1 of the beginning business section of the New York Times. The very next day, I start to get angry calls from locksmiths saying, you know, how can you be so completely irresponsible to, you know, reveal this thing, you know, that you've applied these techniques that only a genius like you could figure out. And now everyone knows, right, and the world is going to be completely insecure as a result of this. And in fact, the locksmith at the university I'm at, who seemed to not know that I had a job that I can't be fired from, but he didn't, would write regular letters to the head of public safety demanding that I be removed from the campus as a security risk for teaching this crazy stuff. And, you know, that never actually happened. The funny thing was, you know, I went around and gave this talk, and invariably, every time I'd give this talk to, like, a group of computer scientists, somebody would raise their hand, oh, yeah, I remember back when I was in college, that's how we made the master key to the dorms, right? Everybody who looks at this from an engineering perspective found the same attack. Nobody actually bothered to write it down. I was just sort of the first person to write it up. So this idea that I discovered this thing, I am the smartest person in the world. No one else will ever discover this. You are always wrong about this.
So I've been meaning to ask you this for a while, Scott. Can we have a lockpick village here at some point?
Yeah.
Is that doable, or is that something that would...
I brought my kit just to...
Is that doable, or would that have to be... Yeah.
The problem... So I already had this conversation with one of the lockpick groups. The problem is that they want to be able to sell their stuff to make it financially viable for them to come, and then that runs into contractual problems with the hotels. So what they can do is they can... I can give them a panel, and they can sell in their own panel, but after that, I have to cut it off.
Okay, hypothetically so. Speaking, if they had, say, a room or a suite or something in the hotel, and, like, they did a panel to talk about lockpicks and stuff like that and do some demos and then announce that, oh, by the way, we're in room such and such, and we've got a lockpick village up there if you want to learn more about this at length outside the confines of a one-hour panel, how would something like that work?
What goes on between the hotel and the occupant of a room or suite is between the hotel and the occupant. So it's an official event.
Yeah. Shall we just say the Vegas rule? Like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Right. What happens in Dragon Con stays at
it's
Dragon
Con. It's pretty much the same idea.
I'm all thinking right. This is not a panel. It would be a meetup.
Or we could simply have a 3-day panel about how to pick locks.
An unofficial 3-day panel hosted in not one of the con rooms.
We can have a panel, but to continue it through the rest of the weekend, they'll need a space.
Yeah, I've had people from Georgia ISS mention something similar, like having a weekend-long Capture the Flag event using the open-source network King of the Hill package. If y'all don't know about that, most of the development going on now is at Georgia Tech. It's a fantastic free and open source Capture the Flag tool that's used at a larger and larger number of conventions, 2,600 meetings and Linux user group meetings. So I'd love to have something like that running all weekend at Dragon Con with a panel or two on the EFF track to tell people about it, get them started, and then point them to where it's happening the entire weekend. Just a thought.
All right. I think we got a question.
Yeah, we have a guy very, very patient. Thank you so much, sir.
Let me guess,
you and then you, and then you'll be number 3, which means we'll probably get to you about 4 a.m.
Okay, so now for something completely different. And I'm asking this here because I don't know where else to ask it, but I know...
If we don't know the answer, we'll make one up.
Okay, I don't know why he's pointing at me. I know, Johnny, you mentioned that you have some contacts in Google. I don't know if anybody...
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, you can hear. You mentioned you had some contacts in Google. I don't know how many of the rest of you do. Some don't remember how long ago it was, but they collected a rather large archive of Usenet, and then appeared to forget that they own it.
Yeah.
Do any of your contacts know what happened with that, and if there is any hope of the archive getting into the hands of anyone who will not cover it with a layer of shit?
Here's the problem with it. They you know, do the AdWords thing with it, so they make a little bit of money, but they make a lot more from Google Groups, which is everything that's happened since they bought. It's the old Alta Vista archive is what they bought. And the problem is, once they set up Google Groups, they can claim semi-legitimately that they've got some vested IP interest in that, and they can legally do the AdWords. And as far as I know, that hadn't gone to court yet. And the problem is, with the Alta Vista archive, if they do the AdWords stuff with that, people who wrote those original posts, like me, I've got a shitload of old Usenet posts on like Alt Horror Cthulhu, could have issues with that and say, well, you know, if you're making money off stuff I wrote and posted online, and technically that's, technically I own the copyright on that, but you're monetizing that and I'm not getting any of that. That's where the issue comes in, as I understand it. The last time I actually got a response on this, which was over 5 years ago.
I was just going to say, this seems like a good time to plug Internet Archive, though. Like,
I've suggested, you know, why not turn it over to Internet Archive? And the problem is, they do make just enough money off of it, and they paid money for the Alta Vista Archive. So they're not ready to let it go yet, because they haven't, as far as I understand, made their money back, and they want to continue making money off of it. If they donate it to the Internet Archive, I guess the tax write-off for that isn't big enough to make it worthwhile, and no one in Google really gives a shit about it anymore, because it's, you know, it's old stuff.
But archive.org hasn't logged it? Like, it's not available if you were to go to, like, the Wayback Machine?
I'm kind of wondering. There's a couple of, I'm going to say the magic word here, so watch for the reaction, Perl scripts. There we go. There's
Thank God you said Pearl.
We will talk after DragonCon, because I need your advice on something. There was a great Pearl script. Free, obviously. Dustin, I'll get to you in a minute, and I'm going to turn things over to you so I can scarf pizza. There was a great Perl script that would let you go through the Yahoo groups and basically scrape a Yahoo group, so you could download all that stuff basically in inbox format, import it to whatever your favorite mail reader was. You wouldn't have to be online.
Yeah.
That got broken when they did their like JavaScript update a few years ago, but there's now a new Perl script out that'll still do the same thing. It doesn't have quite all the functionality. It's not quite as good as the old one, which is why I'm going to talk to you at some point about helping me with a Perl project. I can also show off to NASA, say, yeah, I know Perl. See, I wrote this. After I get the extra functionality and make the baby steps on this Yahoo group Perl scraping script, I want to implement that for the old Alta Vista archive on Google Groups and just set it up to step through and pull all that stuff down and start hosting it elsewhere, so you can access it offline. But Google does not want you to do that, and I don't want to sacrifice my 20-year-old Gmail Google accounts for that yet. So I have to set up some fake ones to test that out.
I've tried that, and it shits on me when I try.
Talk to me later when we break up into unofficial groups. I've got some ideas on that, and I've got a few other people interested in working on that. This information is locked up in Google. It's basically Usenet archives, kind of, for a while, the history of the Internet as developed online, going from all the way to the early 1980s up until whenever Alta Vista went under, I think around the mid to late 90s, and then Google bought that archive. Yep. And my main gripe with Google about this is they haven't maintained it or taken care of it. A lot of the indexes are broken, and they've actually... Not to
mention that trying to post through it is so horrible that everybody else on Usenet.
Well, they've also started randomly. Not randomly, but they've eliminated. I don't know if they've deleted the data, but they've eliminated access to some of the Usenet groups, and they'll remove posts from others. And it's kind of like a private organization now owns this library of public postings on the early history and development of the Internet, and they're just going through saying, "Oh, we don't like that. That offends us. That's not politically correct." And I'm going to feel weird saying this, but there is context and backstory to this. The way I was tweaked into this, when a friend got in touch with me and said, yeah, I know you worked at Google very recently, and I need access to the alt-politics white power news group. And hang on. And I know this guy. I mean, he used to do the radio stuff with me, and I knew he wasn't an alt-right type. And I was like, okay, why should I care about that news group? And he said, there's a guy running for a local office up where I live. He's up in Brown University now. He's got a PhD in library science, cool guy. And he said, and this guy, I've got about 90% of the information I need to connect this candidate to being a regular poster on alt politics, white power, but the news group has suddenly disappeared, and I really want to make that connection public before the elections roll around. So, yeah, if I can prove that this person running for local political office is also this rather horrible, even by alt politics, white power standards, poster to this news group for over a decade, and now suddenly I can't access it, and Google seems to be the only organization that owns the archive going back that far, and now they've removed access to the news group. What can you do about it? And long story short, there wasn't anything I could really do about it, but it got me wondering, okay, what else are they getting rid of? And I'd actually gotten in touch with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they said, yeah, we were kind of annoyed about that too. I mean, that's a way we keep track of people and can provide historical basis for people who have obviously, for people who have not come out publicly and said, yes, I did this in the past, I was stupid, I disown it, I am no longer that person, you know, blah, 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 and people who want to kind of hide that and maybe continue those views and hold public office, so.
I wonder if there's any hope that archive.org or a similar organization could just raise money to outright buy the archive from Google.
I'm wondering maybe if crowdsourcing, not Kickstarter, there are limitations to that, but GoFundMe might be better. I've been exploring different crowdfunding options for different projects. So we'll talk later. I hope that answers your question.
But at least for now, if you search for Johnny X Cthulhu, you will find all of these posts.
Oh, they actually fixed
yes,
my,
they
yeah,
actually,
for a while.
Yes.
For a while, I couldn't find any of them.
Yeah, you can still find on from Alt-Horror Cthulhu.
Fantastic. See if what you can find. There's probably more W.D. Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, from Alt-Horror Cthulhu.
I need to go find all the baggy pants posts from Alt-Gotek. that was the in Georgia Tech. If you walked away from your dumb terminal, that's how old I am. You would find out that you had posted on alt.gotek that some story about how baggy your pants were. It's you know something that you only understand if you go to Georgia Tech. And the weirdest thing is a lot of people that went to Georgia Tech also went to work for ISS. And then IBM bought ISS. And I'm in the Italian, IBM office. And somebody said, oh, man, I've been pantsed. And I said, what? Did you go to Georgia Tech? They're like, no. And like we had to do the how many degrees of separation. And Rebecca realized that, that the guys that went to Georgia Tech went to ISS, got into IBM. And now IBMers think that, being pantsed is a thing. I'm like, no, dude, that's a Georgia Tech thing. But anyway. So alt.gotek, there's lots of good, great, great creative stories about how baggy my pants were.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to jump in for just a minute. I do deeply, deeply apologize. But we do have pizza here. And usually we break at midnight, but we actually planned ahead this time, so the pizza is here earlier than midnight. Do we want to go ahead and take a break for about 15, 20 minutes or so, grab some pizza? We've got chicken wings too, apparently. Grab some liquid refreshment, entertainment, then reconvene more informally. Dustin's going to take over the rest. Yeah, I guess I'm losing the audience now. So people who have got projects to demo here will also hook up projects, demo them. I believe we've got one gentleman here who's got some Raspberry Pis with a shitload of gaming ROMs on them that we're going to try to hook up to the projector and play around with those. We may even have some for sale. And yeah, if you're not 21 or if we suspect
David Stockard, get up here now, please.
If we suspect you're not 21, we're going to, like, grill you if we see you with any alcohol in your hand. So, all right. I'm going to call it officially. Everyone take 5, 10, whatever. Smoke them if you got them. We'll meet back up here at midnight and continue Q&A. That's good enough for me.